Chapter 28. Bloody Legislation Against the Expropriated, from the end of the 15th century. Forcing Down of Wages, by Acts of Parliament. The proletariat, created by the breaking up of the bands of feudal retainers, and by the forcible expropriation of the people from the soil, this free proletariat could not possibly be absorbed by the nascent manufactures as fast as it was thrown upon the world. On the other hand, these men, suddenly dragged from their wonted mode of life, could not as suddenly adapt themselves to the discipline of their new condition. They were turned en masse into beggars, robbers, vagabonds, partly from inclination, in most cases from stress of circumstances. Hence, at the end of the 15th, and during the whole of the 16th century, throughout Western Europe, a bloody legislation against vagabondage. The fathers of the present working class were chastised for their enforced transformation into vagabonds and paupers. Legislation treated them as voluntary criminals, and assumed that it depended on their own good will to go on working under the old conditions that no longer existed. In England, this legislation began under Henry VII. Henry VIII, 1530. Beggars old and unable to work receive a beggar's license. On the other hand, whipping and imprisonment for sturdy vagabonds. They are to be tied to the cart tail and whipped until the blood streams from their bodies, then to swear an oath to go back to their birthplace or to where they have lived the last 3 years and to put themselves to labour. What grim irony! In 27 Henry VIII, the former statute is repeated, but strengthened with new clauses. For the second arrest for vagabondage, the whipping is to be repeated, and half the ear sliced off. But for the third relapse, the offender is to be executed as a hardened criminal and enemy of the common weal. Edward VI. A statute of the first year of his reign, 1547, ordains that if anyone refuses to work, he shall be condemned as a slave to the person who has denounced him as an idler. The master shall feed his slave on bread and water, weak broth, and such refuse meat as he thinks fit. He has the right to force him to do any work, no matter how disgusting, with whip and chains. If the slave is absent a fortnight, he is condemned to slavery for life, and is to be branded on forehead or back with the letter S. If he runs away thrice, he is to be executed as a felon. The master can sell him, bequeath him, let him out on hire as a slave, just as any other personal chattel or cattle. If the slaves attempt anything against the masters, they are also to be executed. Justices of the peace, on information, are to hunt the rascals down. If it happens that a vagabond has been idling about for 3 days, he is to be taken to his birthplace, branded with a red-hot iron with the letter V on the breast, and be set to work in chains in the streets or at some other labour. If the vagabond gives a false birthplace, he is then to become the slave for life of this place, of its inhabitants, or its corporation, and to be branded with an S. All persons have the right to take away the children of the vagabonds, and to keep them as apprentices, the young men until the 24th year, the girls until the 20th. If they run away, they are to become, up to this age, the slaves of their masters, who can put them in irons, whip them, etc., if they like. Every master may put an iron ring round the neck, arms, or legs of his slave, by which to know him more easily, and to be more certain of him. Footnote. The author of The Essay on Trade, etc., 1770, says, "In the reign of Edward VI, indeed the English seem to have set in good earnest about encouraging manufactures and employing the poor. This we learn from a remarkable statute which runs thus, that all vagrants shall be branded, etc. End of footnote. The last part of this statute provides that certain poor people may be employed by a place or by persons who are willing to give them food and drink and to find them work. This kind of parish slaves was kept up in England until far into the 19th century under the name of roundsmen. Elizabeth, 1572. Unlicensed beggars above 14 years of age are to be severely flogged and branded on the left ear unless someone will take them into service for 2 years. In case of a repetition of the offence, if they are over 18, they are to be executed, unless someone will take them into service for 2 years. But for the third offence, they are to be executed without mercy, as felons. Similar statutes, 18 Elizabeth, chapter 13, and another of 1597. Footnote. Thomas More says, in his Utopia, "For when an insatiable wretch, who is a plague to his country, resolves to enclose many thousand acres of ground, the owners, as well as tenants, are turned out of their possessions by trick or by main force, or, being wearied out by ill usage, they are forced to sell them, by which means those miserable people, both men and women, married and unmarried, old and young, with their poor but numerous families, since country business requires many hands, are all forced to change their seats, not knowing whither to go, and they must sell, almost for nothing, their household stuff, which could not bring them much money, even though they might stay for a buyer. When that little money is at an end, for it will be soon spent, what is left for them to do but either to steal, and so to be hanged, God knows how justly, or to go about and beg? And if they do this, they are put in prison as idle vagabonds, while they would willingly work, but can find none that will hire them." Of these poor fugitives, of whom Thomas More says that they were forced to thieve, 7,000 great and petty thieves were put to death in the reign of Henry VIII. Holinshed said, Description of England, Volume 1. Elizabeth's time, rogues were trussed up apace, and that there was not 1 year commonly wherein 300 or 400 were not devoured and eaten up by the gallows. Stripes, Annals of the Reformation and Establishment of Religion and Other Various Occurrences in the Church of England During Queen Elizabeth's Happy Reign, 1725. According to this same Stripe, in Somersetshire in 1 year, 40 persons were executed, 35 robbers burnt in the hand, 37 whipped, and 183 discharged as incorrigible vagabonds. Nevertheless, he is of the opinion that this large number of prisoners does not comprise even a fifth of the actual criminals, thanks to the negligence of the justices and the foolish compassion of the people. And the other counties of England were not better off in this respect than Somersetshire, while some were even worse. End of footnote. James I. Anyone wandering about and begging is declared a rogue and a vagabond. Justices of the peace in petty sessions are authorised to have them publicly whipped and for the first offence to imprison them for 6 months, for the second for 2 years. Whilst in prison they are to be whipped as much and as often as the justices of the peace think fit. Incorrigible and dangerous rogues are to be branded with an R on the left shoulder and set to hard labour, and if they are caught begging again, to be executed without mercy. These statutes, legally binding until the beginning of the 18th century, were only repealed by 12 Anne, chapter 23. Similar laws in France, where by the middle of the 17th century a kingdom of vagabonds, truands, was established in Paris. Even at the beginning of Louis XVI's reign, Ordinance of July the 13th, 1777, every man in good health from 16 to 60 years of age, if without means of subsistence and not practising a trade, is to be sent to the galleys. Of the same nature are the Statute of Charles the Fifth for the Netherlands, October 1537, the first Edict of the States and Towns of Holland, March the 10th, 1614, the Placard of the United Provinces, June the 26th, 1649, etc. Thus were the agricultural people first forcibly expropriated from the soil, driven from their homes, turned into vagabonds, and then whipped, branded, tortured by laws grotesquely terrible into the discipline necessary for the wage system. It is not enough that the conditions of labour are concentrated in a mass, in the shape of capital, at the one pole of society, while at the other are grouped masses of men who have nothing to sell but their labour power. Neither is it enough that they are compelled to sell it voluntarily. The advance of capitalist production develops a working class, which, by education, tradition, habit, looks upon the conditions of that mode of production as self-evident laws of nature. The organisation of the capitalist process of production, once fully developed, breaks down all resistance. The constant generation of a relative surplus population keeps the law of supply and demand of labour, and therefore keeps wages in a rut that corresponds with the wants of capital. The dull compulsion of economic relations completes the subjection of the labourer to the capitalist. Direct force outside economic conditions is of course still used, but only exceptionally. In the ordinary run of things, the labourer can be left to the natural laws of production, that is, to his dependence on capital, a dependence springing from and guaranteed in perpetuity by the conditions of production themselves. It is otherwise during the historic genesis of capitalist production. The bourgeoisie, at its rise, wants and uses the power of the state to regulate wages, that is, to force them within the limits suitable for surplus value making, to lengthen the working day and to keep the labourer himself in the normal degree of dependence. This is an essential element of the so-called primitive accumulation. The class of wage labourers which arose in the latter half of the 14th century formed then and in the following century only a very small part of the population, well protected in its position by the independent peasant proprietary in the country and the guild organisation in the town. In country and town, master and workmen stood close together, socially. The subordination of labour to capital was only formal, that is, the mode of production itself had as yet no specific capitalistic character. Variable capital preponderated greatly over constant. The demand for wage labour grew, therefore, rapidly with every accumulation of capital, whilst the supply of wage labour followed but slowly. A large part of the national product changed later into a fund of capitalist accumulation, then still entered into the consumption fund of the labourer. Legislation on wage labour, from the first, aimed at the exploitation of the labourer and, as it advanced, always equally hostile to him, is started in England by the Statute of Labourers of Edward the Third, 1349. The Ordinance of 1350 in France, issued in the name of King John, corresponds with it. Footnote. Whenever the legislature attempts to regulate the differences between masters and their workmen, its counsellors are always the masters, says A. Smith. L'esprit des lois, c'est la propriété, says Languet. End of footnote. English and French legislation run parallel and are identical in purport. So far as the Labour statutes aim at compulsory extension of the working day, I do not return to them, as this point was treated earlier. Chapter 10, Section 5. The Statute of Labourers was passed at the urgent instance of the House of Commons. A Tory says naively, "Formerly the poor demanded such high wages as to threaten industry and wealth. Next, their wages are so low as to threaten industry and wealth equally, and perhaps more, but in another way." Footnote: Sophisms of Free Trade by a Barrister, London, 1850. He adds maliciously, "We were ready enough to interfere for the employer. Can nothing now be done for the employed?" End of footnote. A tariff of wages was fixed by law for town and country, for piecework and day work. The agricultural labourers were to hire themselves out by the year, the town ones, in open market. It was forbidden, under pain of imprisonment, to pay higher wages than those fixed by the statute. But the taking of higher wages was more severely punished than the giving them. So also in sections 18 and 19 of the Statute of Apprentices of Elizabeth. 10 days' imprisonment is decreed for him that pays the higher wages, but 21 days for him that received them. A statute of 1360 increased the penalties and authorized the masters to extort labour at the legal rate of wages by corporal punishment. All combinations, contracts, oaths, etc., by which masons and carpenters reciprocally bound themselves, were declared null and void. Coalition of the labourers is treated as a heinous crime from the 14th century to 1825, the year of the repeal of the laws against trades unions. The spirit of the Statute of Labourers of 1349 and of its offshoots comes out clearly in the fact that indeed a maximum of wages is dictated by the state, but on no account a minimum. In the 16th century, the condition of the labourers had, as we know, become much worse. The money wage rose, but not in proportion to the depreciation of money and the corresponding rise in the price of commodities. Wages, therefore, in reality, fell. Nevertheless, the laws for keeping them down remained in force, together with the ear-clipping and branding of those whom no one was willing to take into service. By the Statute of Apprentices, 5 Elizabeth, Chapter 3, the justices of the peace were empowered to fix certain wages and to modify them according to the time of the year and the price of the commodities. James I extended these regulations of labour also to weavers, spinners, and all possible categories of workers. Footnote: From a clause of Statute 2, James I, Chapter 6, we see that certain clothmakers took upon themselves to dictate, in their capacity of justices of the peace, the official tariff of wages in their own shops. In Germany, especially after the Thirty Years' War, statutes for keeping down wages were general. The want of servants and labourers was very troublesome to the landed proprietors in the depopulated districts. All villagers were forbidden to let rooms to single men and women. All the latter were to be reported to the authorities and cast into prison if they were unwilling to become servants, even if they were employed at any other work, such as sowing seeds for the peasants at a daily wage, or even buying and selling corn. Imperial privileges and sanctions for Silesia. For a whole century, in the decrees of the small German potentates, a bitter cry goes up again and again about the wicked and impertinent rabble that will not reconcile itself to its hard lot, will not be content with the legal wage. The individual landed proprietors are forbidden to pay more than the state had fixed by a tariff. And yet the conditions of service were at times better after war than 100 years later. The farm servants of Cilicia had, in 1652, meat twice a week, whilst even in our century, districts are known where they have it only three times a year. Further, wages after the war were higher than in the following century. G. Freytag. End of footnote. George II extended the laws against coalitions of labourers to manufactures. In the manufacturing period par excellence, the capitalist mode of production had become sufficiently strong to render legal regulation of wages as impracticable as it was unnecessary. But the ruling classes were unwilling, in case of necessity, to be without the weapons of the old arsenal. Still, 8 George II forbade a higher day's wage than 2 shillings and 7 pence halfpenny for journeymen tailors in and around London, except in cases of general mourning. Still, 13 George III, Chapter 68, gave the regulation of the wages of silk weavers to the justices of the peace. Still, in 1706, it required 2 judgments of the higher courts to decide whether the mandates of justices of the peace as to wages held good also for non-agricultural labourers. Still, in 1799, an Act of Parliament ordered that the wages of the Scotch miners should continue to be regulated by a statute of Elizabeth, and 2 Scotch Acts of 1661 and 1671. How completely in the meantime circumstances had changed is proved by an occurrence unheard of before in the English Lower House. In that place, where for more than 400 years laws had been made for the maximum, beyond which wages absolutely must not rise, Whitbread in 1796 proposed a legal minimum wage for agricultural labourers. Pitt opposed this, but confessed that the condition of the poor was cruel. Finally, in 1813, the laws for the regulation of wages were repealed. They were an absurd anomaly, since the capitalist regulated his factory by his private legislation, and could, by the poor rates, make up the wage of the agricultural labourer to the indispensable minimum. The provisions of the labour statutes as to contracts between master and workman, as to giving notice and the like, which only allow of a civil action against the contract-breaking master, but on the contrary permit a criminal action against a contract-breaking workman, are to this hour, 1873, in full force. The barbarous laws against trades unions fell in 1825 before the threatening bearing of the proletariat. Despite this, they fell only in part. Certain beautiful fragments of the old statute vanished only in 1859. Finally, the Act of Parliament of June the 29th, 1871, made a pretense of removing the last traces of this class of legislation by legal recognition of trades unions. But an Act of Parliament of the same date, an Act to amend the criminal law relating to violence, threats, and molestation, re-established, in point of fact, the former state of things in a new shape. By this parliamentary escamotage, the means which the labourers could use in a strike or lockout were withdrawn from the laws common to all citizens and placed under exceptional penal legislation, the interpretation of which fell to the masters themselves in their capacity as justices of the peace. 2 years earlier, the same House of Commons and the same Mr. Gladstone, in the well-known straightforward fashion, brought in a bill for the abolition of all exceptional penal legislation against the working class. But this was never allowed to go beyond the second reading, and the matter was thus protracted until at last the great Liberal Party, by an alliance with the Tories, found courage to turn against the very proletariat that had carried it into power. Not content with this treachery, the great Liberal Party, allowed the English judges, ever complaisant, in the service of the ruling classes, to dig up again the earlier laws against conspiracy, and to apply them to coalitions of labourers. We see that only against its will and under the pressure of the masses did the English Parliament give up the laws against strikes and trades unions, after it had itself, for 500 years, held, with shameless egoism, the position of a permanent trades union of the capitalists against the labourers. During the very first storms of the Revolution, the French bourgeoisie dared to take away from the workers the right of association but just acquired. By a decree of June the 14th, 1791, they declared all coalition of the workers as an attempt against liberty and the Declaration of the Rights of Man, punishable by a fine of 500 livres, together with deprivation of the rights of an active citizen for 1 year. Footnote. Article 1 of this law runs, "As the abolition of any form of association between citizens of the same estate and profession is one of the foundations of the French Constitution, it is forbidden to re-establish them under any pretext or in any form, whatever they might be. Citizens belonging to the same profession, craft, or trade have joint discussions and make joint decisions with the intention of refusing together to perform their trade, or insisting together on providing the services of their trade, or their labours only at a particular price, then the said deliberations and agreements shall be declared unconstitutional, derogatory to liberty and the Declaration of the Rights of Man, etc. Felony, therefore, as in the old labour statutes." Révolution de Paris, Paris, 1791. End of footnote. This law, which, by means of state compulsion, confined the struggle between capital and labour within limits comfortable for capital, has outlived revolutions and changes of dynasties. Even the Reign of Terror left it untouched. It was but quite recently struck out of the penal code. Nothing is more characteristic than the pretext for this bourgeois coup d'état. "Granting," says Chapelier, the reporter of the Select Committee on this law, "that wages ought to be a little higher than they are, that they ought to be high enough for him that receives them to be free from that state of absolute dependence due to the want of the necessaries of life, and which is almost that of slavery. Yet the workers must not be allowed to come to any understanding about their own interests, nor to act in common, and thereby lessen their absolute dependence, which is almost that of slavery. Because, forsooth, in doing this they injure the freedom of their ci-devant masters, the present entrepreneurs. And because a coalition against the despotism of the quondam masters of the corporation is, guess what, is a restoration of the corporations abolished by the French Constitution." Footnote. Boucher et Roux, Histoire parlementaire. End of footnote.